Welcome to Fresh Research, a podcast from the Nonprofit Times, where we explore some of the latest findings focused on the world of charities. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Mark Arivna, senior editor at the Nonprofit Times. Each episode of Fresh Research will examine two recent studies. We'll talk to the authors about what they found and why it's important to nonprofits. We'll also give away some books and highlight access to other valuable information from the Nonprofit Times. Only about half of nonprofits surveyed agree that their executive team communicates to others. Two-thirds agreed that their teams focus on the right work or use their time effectively. Now, that's not Michael Scott-level executive management, but it could use some work. The Bridgespan Group has come up with the first comprehensive study of effective executive teams. Increasing Nonprofit Team Effectiveness was written by Libby Landles-Cobb, a partner in the San Francisco office, along with Henry Barmier and Kirk Kramer. She joins us to talk about some of the findings. We didn't get to the five questions to guide an effective executive team, but be sure to check out that part of the research. Nicholas Duquette will discuss the relationship between income inequality and philanthropy. He's an assistant professor at the Saul Price School of Public Policy at the University of Southern California. His paper is titled Inequality and Philanthropy, High Income Giving in the United States, 1917 to 2012. Over the last 95 years, giving by high-income households has moved inversely with income inequality. You'll want to stick around for the second segment for more details on what he found. Libby Landles-Cobb, partner in the San Francisco office of the Bridgespan Group. Thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Now, the study is called Increasing Nonprofit Team Effectiveness, and what you believe to be the first comprehensive study of effective executive teams. Should some of the numbers be concerning to nonprofits, or are they concerning to you in terms of how many folks agree that executive teams are essentially effective?
Yeah. So this work came up for us because we have worked with nonprofit executive teams as part of our work at Bridgespan for the last 18 years. So we've had the opportunity to see the potential that the executive teams in the nonprofit sector have for driving the kind of results and impact we all desire. And while the data is quite concerning, I will say that many folks, so the numbers that you were looking at are quite low, like 19% of folks strongly believe that their teams are focused on the right work. Many of the folks who responded to the survey agreed that they were focused on the right work, but didn't strongly agree. And I think that distinction is important because, one, that means that there are not houses burning all over the nonprofit sector, but the potential for upside to go from 3 to 4 to get from a place where organizations are, teams are relatively clear about what they're focusing on to really, really clear, I think is huge because the executive team time is the most expensive on the payroll. When you bring executives together, you are asking them, the cost of the salaries in the room is the highest of the organization, but the opportunity cost of what they could be doing as individual leaders outside of that meeting room is really great. And so you need to be making the most of that time. The other thing I will say is, my experience having worked with nonprofit executive teams is even those who rate themselves a 3 out of 4 actually don't know the potential they have as a team once they understand what good could really look like. So getting clear about the work that they need to be focusing on, maximizing the use of the time that they have, really does have a huge amount of upside. So I think there is a call to action for all nonprofits here, even though I don't think everyone should run around thinking the whole house is on fire.
The distinction you make between strongly agree and agree is interesting. Is it a matter of some nonprofits think, well, we're good, but we're not great? And going back to, say, the old book, From Good to Great, is it that much of a difference between agree versus strongly agree? Because a lot of the questions that you went through, you still have a vast majority that either agree or strongly agree. It's just a smaller percentage of strongly. I think I'm looking through most of them, and most every question was at least 2/3 to 3/4 of folks at least agreed.
That's right. So, I mean, again, I think part of that is that folks are relatively okay with the time that they're spending together. But when we work with teams who, even those who rate themselves a 3, when they really spend the time to get clear about why they need to be spending time together and how they can be doing that to the highest and best use, they find there's actually probably a lot more upside. I think one telling thing is that one of the highest scoring metrics that we found in our survey was that people get along well together. I can't remember exactly the right wording of the question, but essentially, you know, I like the team members that I'm working with, and that's a wonderful foundation, right? You need to be able to get along. You need to work well together as a team. But we think these other elements of, are you really clear about the work that you as a unit, as an executive team, should be spending your time together on versus others in the organization versus, you know, some subset of those folks working outside of the meeting room? That's where the potential is to really help teams get more clear about how to best use their time together as a unit.
The lowest percentage among the questions for agreeing and strongly agree was executive teams communicating to each other. Overall, they agreed 52%, which is really just 52 and 48, half and half. 11% strongly agreed and 41% agreed. But all the other questions are pretty much at least 70 or 80%. Is that usually what you found in working with clients or other nonprofits? Is that's usually the issue, is simply communicating?
So the question, that particular question was not around communicating with each other. It was about communicating to the broader organization. And I think this is a pretty chronic challenge in the nonprofit sector. So what happens in that room is a little bit of a black box for the organization. And what is discussed at the executive team table has serious implications for the whole organization. And so getting more systematic and thoughtful about how both what was discussed at the executive team meetings, but also how it affects the rest of the organization and the follow through that happens after those meetings is significantly lacking in the sector. The way we see that manifesting itself is lack of transparency, lack of trust between the broader organization and the executive team, lack of, you know, follow through and execution. If you don't know how the executive team was discussing something or even what they discussed, it's hard for the organization to really get aligned with the really important decisions that happen around that table.
In that case, it's a matter of simply communicating throughout the organization about basically what the executive team is doing.
That's right. So what we recommend is that a really simple way to start to address this is to force your executive team meeting agendas to end 10 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes early, so that you can pull up from whatever complex conversation you have, probably in some cases not a finished conversation, and agree on what did we just decide, who needs to know about it, and what are we going to do to make sure that that happens, so that the team is aligned on how they're talking about it, that it's clear who's going to be saying what to whom, so that the thoughtful rollout is happening across the organization. Just that practice alone can really help and help increase some of the transparency challenges we see.
Were there any other areas of concern you think that charity should be aware of, whether it was about those questions or just other areas of the study?
Yeah, I would say the biggest takeaway for us, and I think the biggest place where executive teams can have the most opportunity for improvement, is really around getting clear about what they should be spending their time on. I can't harp on that enough. Where a couple of symptoms that we see nonprofits struggling with. One is that they are focusing on things that do not require the whole team. So that they're, you know, whatever challenge they're having in their department, they bring to this team. And it may better be solved between that department or within people closer to the front lines of the organization, for instance. But on the flip side, there are issues that executive teams should be focusing on that have high implications for the organization that get missed out because the team isn't clear. So a big one that we see is really owning at the executive team level, developing and cultivating pipelines of talent within the organization. That should be owned by the executive team, and therefore their time and space needs to be made. And then the third is just using executive team time for things like updates and share outs and information sharing that could be done in a different place where you don't need people in the room. Executive team time should really be spent sharing and working together and digesting issues together and making joint decisions. And so the practice that we saw in our research that we think is really helpful is to ask two questions for all nonprofit executive teams. The first is an issue interdependent? So does it require the perspectives, input, shared ownership of multiple people around the table? Is it really good use of the team's time? And the second is it high stakes? So does it have significant implications for the sustainability and the success and impact of the organization overall? It's the intersection of those two, high interdependence and high stakes, where the executive team should really be spending their time. And this means that often a lot of things that come to the table, which feel really urgent and high stakes in that moment, may actually need to play somewhere else.
Libby Landels-Cobb, a partner in the San Francisco office of the Bridgespan Group. Thanks so much for joining me today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Share the latest episode of Fresh Research on social media, and you could find something special in the mail next month. And by something special, I mean a book from the extensive library here at the Nonprofit Times. Follow the lead of Maria Isabel Rosario of Boston-based Community Resources for Justice. She retweeted and shared an episode on Twitter and found herself to be the owner of a new book. Use the hashtag #FreshResearch. And if that's asking too much, maybe you can rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. It'll help other people find the show. So, Nick, where did you get the idea to come up with this paper? What prompted you to take a look at this data?
Well, the question I originally thought I wanted to answer was trying to put numbers on how much philanthropy distorts our idea of how unequal everything really is. What I thought I was going to find was that, yes, inequality has risen in income, but if the people who have high incomes are giving away more and more of their money to libraries and parks and things that benefit everybody, then that could have misleadingly overstated the extent of inequality. And so my original idea was that I would show that inequality and philanthropy went hand in hand, and the true inequality after you adjust for the contributions that high-income households make to public amenities, you know, once we accounted for that, that we would see income inequality was not quite as severe as some of the recent research has shown.
What you actually did find?
So what I actually did find was that when income inequality has been high, such as between the world wars or in the last couple of decades, the share of income that high-income households have been giving to charity, at least the contributions that they've been listing on their tax returns, has been relatively low. And in the middle of the 20th century, when income inequality was relatively low, charitable contributions was relatively high. So the pattern historically has been exactly the opposite of what you would expect, that the share of income that the people at the top are giving away is actually a lot higher when income has been more equally distributed than when it's been very unequal. And really the meat of the paper, to be blunt, is beating this correlation over and over again, trying to figure out whether it is really just explained away by something else. Maybe it's changes in the composition of where income at the top is coming from. Maybe it's changes in tax rates that give different incentives to make charitable contributions over time. Is there anything that I can find that would explain this away or put an asterisk on it that maybe it's not really what we're seeing and that my numbers are misleading? And after, you know, just a succession of different attempts to investigate, does this association hold up in the when we control for other explanations? Does it disappear when we look at inequality across U.S. states, some of which are more unequal than others over time? I just keep finding the same association again and again. When there's more inequality, there is relatively less charitable giving by the households at the top.
And I noticed in the paper itself, you've got a lot of figures and tables that academic papers generally do, of course. But there was one striking chart in there where there was a big gap between the 50s and the 80s. Is that graphically your thesis there in terms of the big change between inequality and philanthropy?
I think the graph that you're describing is, I guess this is the problem with doing things with audio, but you can visualize it as a letter U and an upside down letter U, by which I mean that if you look at the income inequality in the United States over the past 100 years, it's U-shaped. So things are very unequal at the beginning of the 20th century. Then there's a depression and the Second World War, which causes a major economic transformation, and things become very equal in the middle 20th century. So inequality goes down, and that's the bottom of the U. And then things begin to change in the 1970s and really pick up in the 1980s, and income inequality becomes very high again. So over the last 100 years, the trajectory of income inequality has had this U shape. And then the other thing that I plot on that same chart is the share of income that the high-income households are donating. And that follows an upside-down U path. It's very low at the beginning of the 20th century, and then it becomes very high in the middle And then just as inequality is taking off again in the 1980s, it starts to decline fairly rapidly and has become not quite as low as it was in the 19-teens and the 1920s, but definitely well below where it was in the middle of the 20th century, the 50s and 60s.
And I guess the question then is, the basic question is why? Is it a matter of, I know you mentioned in your paper as well, tax rates, high income tax rates were pretty high in the mid 20th century. You also had a booming economy, more of a middle class, and I guess, you know, less inequality. Is that the basics of it?
So those are definitely contributing factors. Mm-hmm. In the middle of the 20th century, the Korean War era and the early 1960s, before Kennedy and Johnson and their congresses started passing tax cuts, income tax rates were high to an extent that seems just impossible to us today. The top rate at one point was 91%. And even if you weren't a multimillionaire, you know, the rate brackets kept going higher and higher and higher. And so if you were a high income person and you were facing a tax rate in the 80s and in the 90s, in the 1950s and 60s, then you were almost indifferent between whether you were going to make a little bit of extra money or donate that money to your favorite charity. If you're paying 91%, then it only costs you the other 9% to give a dollar away, and the rest of it just comes off your tax bill. So that's definitely a big part of it. But what I show in the rest of the paper, and the, you know, all of those tables that are less visually striking than the simple time plot, is that even after you control for those tax incentives, and even after you control for the booms and busts in the economy, you still see this negative association where the more unequal periods are correlated with lower giving, even after you've taken out the tax stuff, even after you've taken out the economic booms. It's still there.
And I know one of the issues that the nonprofit sector has faced over the last several years, maybe even the last decade, is more of a share of donations coming from the higher end of household incomes. Is that something that you can delve into at all as a result of this study, or is it apples and orange?
I'm not sure how tightly related those two problems are. You can definitely see in the same data that I used to write this paper that more and more of the giving is coming from people who are higher income, and that the people who make large donations are responsible for a rising share of all of the giving that is going on. But there's more to it going on than just the income inequality story. You see in the tax data and in the survey that they do at the Indiana School of Philanthropy that the share of people who don't give anything has been going up over time too.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's more to it than simply, you know, the people who have all the money are paying the piper. We see that, well, for one thing, the share they are giving away is not keeping up with the increases in their income in the first place. But also, I think that idea that, you know, nonprofits are dependent on a shrinking pool of mega donors is coming from a variety of different pressures that we don't yet fully understand.
Nick, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. It's been a really interesting discussion.
Thank you for having me.
That's Nicholas Duquette, assistant professor at the Saul Price School of Public Policy at the University of Southern California. That's another episode in the books. Thanks for listening, and special thanks to our guests for taking the time to join us. Don't forget, share the Fresh Research link on Twitter or Facebook to be eligible to win a book from the NPT Library. Use the hashtag FreshResearch or tweet us at Nonprofit Times. And if you like what you hear, please rate us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Arivna for the Nonprofit Times, and this has been Fresh Research, a podcast about some of the latest research in the philanthropic sector. Until next time, keep up with us at thenonprofittimes.com.